12. Upper Makefield Township, Pennsylvania, December 15, 1776, 1 p.m. George Washington is desperate. "These are the times that try men's souls," pamphlet writer Thomas Paine will soon write, summing up Washington's seemingly hopeless situation. Footnote: Paine, who also wrote Common Sense, published The American Crisis on December 19, 1776, perhaps the darkest hour in the short history of America. It read, "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of his country, but he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph." End footnote. Now, a lone horseman gallops up the lane on the general's headquarters in a Pennsylvania farmhouse. Footnote: the house belonged to William Keith, who purchased the 230-acre site in 1761. Many of his neighbors were Quakers, who followed their religious principles and treated the War of Rebellion with pacifist indifference. But the Scots-Irish Keith was a prominent Presbyterian and a rebel sympathizer. When he learned that the rebels were nearby, he offered the home to George Washington, who used it as his headquarters from December 14th to 24th, 1776. Legend has it that one of Washington's top spies, John Honeyman, whom the British believed to be a loyalist, was secretly sequestered in a small stone house on the Keith property in order to pass along news of Hessian troop movements in Trenton without being seen. The house still stands. End footnote. On this freezing morning, Washington is glad for the warmth provided by a stone fireplace taller than a man. Through the large bay windows facing the main road, he can see that the riders' boots and coats are slick with mud, the obvious result of a hard, cold gallop over winter roads. It is Sunday morning, normally a time of ease, but today fear and anxiety grip General Washington. These express riders seldom bring good news, so the mere sight of the messenger chills the colonial leader. Washington does not know how much more bad news he can take. It has been a year and a half since His Excellency assumed command of the Continental Army. After the early promise of his success in Boston, the past 3 months have seen one setback after another. In a disastrous battle on November 16th, British forces captured the vital stronghold of Fort Washington, overlooking the Hudson River, taking 2,800 rebels prisoner. 3 days later, the British crossed the Hudson to capture a second waterfront citadel named Fort Lee, sending Washington's army into full retreat to escape annihilation. Footnote: Fort Washington is now the Washington Heights section of Manhattan. Fort Lee is now a riverfront town in New Jersey. End footnote. The rebel troops did not halt until they had pulled back all the way across New Jersey, over the Delaware River, and into the thick woods of the Pennsylvania countryside. Right now, George Washington desperately needs his top commander, General Charles Lee, to march his army south from the center of New Jersey to reunite with Washington's command. Lee claims to have thousands of men at his disposal, so the combined numbers of their troops might be enough for the rebels to launch a surprise offensive into British lines. After the disastrous New York campaign, such thinking is foolhardy, but Washington believes that now is the time for daring. This despite the fact that his own command is smaller than Lee's. Alarmingly, hundreds of Washington's troops are deserting, returning to their homes rather than endure another freezing night in a makeshift camp and sure death at the hands of the approaching British. Throughout the colonies, it is becoming a common belief that the war is lost. Just 2 weeks ago, on November 30th, the British offered a complete pardon to all colonists who would pledge their peaceable obedience and complete allegiance to the king. Thousands of citizens are coming forth to take this pledge, putting Washington and the Continental Army in the dangerous role of possibly being the enemy to their own countrymen. But George Washington refuses to give up. He has no definitive reconnaissance, but he believes that his longtime adversary, General William Howe, stands poised on the opposite side of the Delaware River, ready to invade Pennsylvania. Washington has taken the extraordinary step of destroying boats on the New Jersey side of the river for 60 miles up and down the Delaware, but still he fears that Howe will find a way to cross. A heavy freeze has just set in, with the promise of a hard storm from the northeast soon to bring snow and frigid temperatures. Should the Delaware harden to ice, as it does each winter, Howe will simply march his men and cannon across the frozen surface. Then comes good news. American troops under General Lee are on the march, headed toward Washington. When Lee arrives, today, it is hoped, the colonial forces will be doubled. Indeed, an optimistic Washington is even pondering a surprise offensive when that reunion takes place. "We have 3,000 men here at present," Lee wrote to Washington just days ago, once again finding a way to slow down his march. "But they are so ill-shod that we have been obliged to halt these 2 days for lack of shoes." Washington is impatient for Lee's arrival, but just as aware that blending the two commands will bring headaches. The British-born Lee considers himself superior to Washington and often ignores orders. Over the last week, Washington has repeatedly pleaded for Lee to make haste for his headquarters, but the general has not listened, and has complained about Washington in letters to other American leaders. As of 5 days ago, their forces were just 50 miles apart. Just yesterday, Washington sent a messenger to Lee. "I have so frequently mentioned our situation and the necessity of your aid that it is painful to me to add a word upon the subject. Let me once more request and entreat you to march immediately." Now, with the sun already fading in the early afternoon, the Lone Rider dismounts. Shaking off the cold, he tethers his horse and marches up the steps and into the farmhouse, where he hands a missive to a member of Washington's staff. The message is then hand-delivered to Washington, who is sitting inside. The news could not be worse. 2 days earlier, General Charles Lee is sitting down to breakfast at 10 o'clock in the morning. It is Friday the 13th. And the tavern in which he has spent the night smells of last night's spilled beer and unwashed patrons. A dozen men stand guard outside to protect Lee. 19-year-old Major James Wilkinson, an aide to American General Horatio Gates, stands near the window, waiting impatiently for Lee to complete a letter to Wilkinson's superior so that the young man might return with it to Gates's headquarters. The general is on the march now from the Hudson River Valley south to Washington's location. Footnote. Although very young, Major James Wilkinson had already served under Nathaniel Greene and Benedict Arnold. He fell out with Arnold when the commander demanded that Wilkinson shoot his horse in the midst of his retreat from Canada. Wilkinson did as ordered, but felt Arnold to be unnecessarily cruel. Wilkinson would later become infamous for acts of treason against the American government during the Louisiana Purchase. Theodore Roosevelt would later say of him, "In all our history, there is no more despicable character." End footnote. But the Widow White's tavern is 3 long miles away from his army. Lee left his troops last night in search of paid female companionship, which he found at the tavern. The weather has turned brutally cold, with snow flurries and frost covering the ground at night. So even as Lee's soldiers, many barefoot and ill, huddle close to their campfires to keep from freezing to death, their leader has slept in a warm bed. He has enjoyed the hot meals, fine Madeira wine, and other pleasures of this small roadside inn. And rather than rise at dawn to resume his march toward Washington, he slept until Wilkinson roused him at 8 a.m. Although refreshed, Lee is in a foul mood, having just spent an hour lambasting an ineffective group of cavalry officers from Connecticut who showed up for their meeting in dress uniform and ceremonial wigs, a situation the crusty Lee found foolish under the circumstances. A half-written letter to his confidant, American General Horatio Gates, lies on the table before him. Lee's white shirt is open at the neck, wrinkled and yellowing. The general wears slippers, but not a hat, and instead of his uniform jacket, he is covered with a thick blanket coat to keep warm. In his letter to Gates, also not a fan of George Washington, Lee labels His Excellency as damnable deficient. "He has thrown me into a situation where I have my choice of difficulties," Lee tells Gates. "If I stay in this province, I risk myself and army. If I do not stay, the province is lost." Suddenly, Major Wilkinson cries out in surprise, "Here, sir, are the British cavalry!" "Where?" Lee demands, hastily signing the letter. "Around the house," Wilkinson replies in terror, witnessing for himself that a group of British soldiers has quickly charged up the lane and surrounded the tavern. "Where is the guard?" Lee demands. "Damn the guard! Why don't they open fire?" But two of the guards are already dead. The rest are running for their lives. The British cavalry opens fire on the tavern through every window and every door, in the words of one of their junior officers, an impudent 22-year-old dragoon from Liverpool named Benastre Tarleton. The British commander, Lieutenant William Harcourt, has ordered his men to cut up as many of the American guard as they could. Footnote: the precise term for Tarleton's rank was that of cornet, a junior grade that corresponded to the naval rank of ensign. It was utilized strictly by cavalry officers. The British Army abolished this term during military reforms in 1871, renaming the rank second lieutenant. The British and American navies still use the rank of ensign. End footnote. The Widow White, fearful that her tavern will be destroyed, runs to the door and screams to the British that Lee is inside. Harcourt immediately orders his men to cease fire, wanting to capture Lee alive. "If the general does not surrender in 5 minutes, I will set fire to the house," he informs the widow. "I give my solemn oath." 2 minutes later, not even taking the time to get properly dressed, General Charles Lee gives himself up. A cowering Wilkinson, who has found a place to evade capture, bears witness. "Lee, mounted on my horse, which stood ready at the door, was hurried off in triumph, bareheaded, in his slippers and blanket coat, his collar open, and his shirt very much soiled from several days' use." A month later, when word of Lee's capture reaches London, bells will be rung in joyful celebration. The Hessians in America will celebrate as well, believing Lee the only rebel general we have cause to fear. It is the news of Lee's capture that General Washington receives at 1 p.m. on December 15th. Almost immediately, a thoroughly disheartened Washington takes quill to paper to put his fears into words. "The game," Washington admits to his younger brother back home in Virginia, "is pretty near up." Footnote: John Augustine Washington was 40 years old and living on his family's plantation, Bushfield, at the time of his brother's letter in 1776. During the war, John Washington served on his county's Committee of Safety, which sought to undermine any Loyalist activity. He died of unknown causes in 1787 and is buried with his wife in an unmarked grave. Their son, Bushrod, went on to become a U.S. Supreme Court justice. End footnote. Word of Lee's capture is immediately messaged to General William Howe. Believing that the rebel army is now shattered and knowing that winter would make roads impassable and encampment unhealthy, he quartered small garrisons in a number of towns in New Jersey along the main route from New York to Philadelphia, then removed his own headquarters to New York City. There, Howe's blonde, blue-eyed mistress from Boston, Elizabeth Loring, awaits him, and he is eager to return to her. Saturday morning, one day after Lee's capture and a day before Washington gets the news, General Howe saddles his horse for the trip to New York. He is accompanied by his top general, Charles Cornwallis, who plans to sail home to England to be with his ill wife until hostilities resume in the spring. But George Washington knows nothing of these movements. New Jersey is so rife with loyalists that his spy network is unable to send him reliable reconnaissance. So rather than settle into a winter camp of his own, he maintains his defensive stance, believing that his army is all that prevents the British from capturing Philadelphia. Congress is also convinced of this and has already fled the city to conduct business in Baltimore. When Washington finally receives word of Howe's departure from the battlefield, he doesn't accept it. Instead, reflecting on the stealthy British tactics used on Long Island, Washington thinks Howe's retreat is a ruse. He knows that a Hessian force numbering almost 1,500 men still remains on the opposite side of the Delaware defending the city of Trenton. Even when the remnants of Lee's army, now numbering just 2,000 men, finally arrive to join his force, Washington frets. The terms of the Continental Army's enlistment contracts stipulate that every soldier will be free to return to his home as of January 1, 1777. With the war going badly, there will be no reason for his troops to risk their lives by re-enlisting. In effect, George Washington is just 2 weeks away from having no army at all. He must, therefore, find a way to keep the rebellion alive. He knows he must accomplish a brilliant stroke to rouse the spirits of our people, which are quite sunk by our misfortunes. Throughout the United States of America and in London and Paris, the thoughts of men, women, and children now turn to Christmas. It will be a time to set the war aside, if only for a day, to celebrate goodwill, hope, and love. But General Washington is not of that mindset. As the days until Christmas count down, he hatches a bold plan. Instead of goodwill, hope, and love, George Washington foresees a Christmas full of carnage, mayhem, and brutal death. The battle password to be used by the Continental Army consists of three short words that summarize not just Washington's state of mind, but the very future of the nation. Victory or death. On Christmas night, a hard winter gale lashes George Washington as he steps into the Black Durham boat that will carry him across the Delaware River. It is just past midnight, and Washington's plan is to launch a surprise attack on Trenton, ferrying his entire army across the swift and wide waterway in the dead of night, then marching 10 miles to the Hessian lines. Spies have already informed the enemy of Washington's plans, but the attack is so far-fetched that the Hessian commander, Colonel Johann Rahl, is making no plans to oppose the crossing. "Let them come," he has responded to the spy. As usual, Rahl is drinking and playing cards as he assesses the situation. "We will go at them with the bayonet." Unlike in Brooklyn, where men fought to get into the boats in their eagerness to retreat, Washington's soldiers now wait patiently for their turn to climb aboard the large vessel and begin their assault. Many stand by campfires, burning every available piece of wood to keep warm. "When I turned my face to the fire, my back would be freezing," one soldier would write. "By turning round and round, I kept myself from perishing." The Delaware River is filled with jagged chunks of ice carried along by a raging current. Under normal conditions, that hazard would be difficult enough, but a perfect hurricane also now blows, stinging the men's faces with snow, sleet, and rain. The soldiers will stand in the flat-bottomed boats, squeezed tightly together as they are rowed across by the same Massachusetts seamen who saved them after the debacle in Brooklyn. Normally used to carry ore, these high-sided boats are strong enough to hold 40 men per load. Indeed, artillery pieces and horses will also make the crossing. But should one of the Durhams strike ice or otherwise be tipped by the abominable conditions, every man aboard will perish. The water is simply too cold and too fast to attempt a rescue. Washington is among the first to cross. He stands in the pointed bow of the boat throughout the journey, his black cape pulled tightly around his shoulders. When the boat reaches the other side, he sits down on a frozen beehive to supervise the unloading of his men. The Continental Army is crossing in three different locations up and down the river with his group at McConkie's Ferry north of Trenton. By 3 a.m., it is done. There has been no loss of life so far, but Washington has no way of knowing that the other two crossing attempts at other points on the river have failed. Because of the harsh weather and increasing ice flows, only Washington's portion of the three-pronged attack could establish itself on the banks of the river. The storm grows in intensity, yet Washington pushes his men forward, desperate to ensure the element of surprise so vital to a successful attack. The road to Trenton is pitch black, and the pace no more than a frozen shuffle. Some of the men see their way by lighting slow-burning lengths of rope designed to be used as cannon fuses. Most wrap rags around their shoes for additional warmth, while many men have no shoes at all. The rags are their only protection from the winter cold. Throughout, Washington rides tall in the saddle, his unmistakable height and profile looming at the side of the men when they least expect it.
"For God's sake, keep with your officers," he encourages those men who slow down or stop.
Soldiers who stop will most likely fall asleep and die before they can awaken. In fact, two rebels freeze to death on the march. Washington himself almost slips off the road when his horse loses its footing on the icy lane and appears about to roll down a steep embankment. Quickly, the general grabs the animal's mane and twists its neck hard, forcing the horse back onto the road and maintaining his own balance and that of his horse. The general is tense and uncharacteristically angry. There can be no mistakes tonight. A lesser commander would have remained behind, leading the action from the safety of a warm farmhouse, yet Washington knows that his men are watching. The future of America hangs on the leadership skills he now must display in the dark and cold. The weather is causing other problems, rendering many of the muskets unusable. The warfare, then, will pit American bayonets against those bayonets used so ruthlessly by the Hessians on Long Island. But even then, the rebels will be at a disadvantage. For every five now useless muskets, the Americans possess just one bayonet. Those men without a blade must make do with gun butts or fists. First light arrives shortly after 7 a.m. Sunrise is 10 minutes later. Still, the rebel soldiers remain undetected. Their movements obscured by the thick snow, the colonial fighters march quietly toward Trenton. It is a small city of just a few taverns, shops, a church, and about 70 homes. It did contain a large permanent barracks building constructed by the British in the 1760s, making it one of the few places in New Jersey suitable for a winter garrison. The Americans have been on their feet for the entire night. They have not slept at all, and despite carrying 3 days' rations, they have little food or drink left. Yet a new burst of energy surges as the men come upon Trenton. Washington calmly orders the attack, telling his 2,400 troops to race quickly into town before the Hessians can respond to any alarms. Reaching the outskirts of Trenton, Washington orders the artillery to fire, formally ending the surprise. As shells rain down on the town, the rebels race through the streets, thrusting their bayonets into the surprised Hessians, whose training ensures a calm professionalism under fire. The two forces, in fact, are a study in military bearing. Exhausted, undernourished, poorly armed rebels versus polished and efficient German mercenary warriors. The Hessians are fond of donning fierce beaked copper helmets in battle. Those able to do so grow fierce black mustaches. There will later be rumors that the Hessians were drunk or hungover that day from too much Christmas cheer, but eyewitnesses will state that is not the case. Career soldiers who have spent their whole lives training for this moment, the Hessians have seen the rebels on the battlefield before and do not respect or fear them. The Americans are simply a nuisance, nothing more,
and the Hessians' plan is repeatedly to run them through with their 17-inch long bayonets. At first, the battle goes well for Washington's troops. His men enter the city before those in the Germans' garrison can rouse themselves from their holiday beds. 6 American cannon fire down King and Queen Streets, their barrels strafing any living being who crosses those thoroughfares. The Hessians call upon their military training and instinctively form into 2 lines, but the instant they fire upon the rebels and attempt to reload, the Americans swarm their position, coming hard at the Hessians with bayonets, hunting knives, musket butts, and fists. Other American soldiers, seeking the momentary warmth of a fireplace, use the attack as an excuse to break into homes currently occupied by Hessians. They flush the Germans into alleys and side streets, where still more Americans pounce upon them. Blood stains the snow as soldiers are speared and left to die where they fall. The Hessian soldiers first registered for military life at the age of 7. For most, their actual service began at the age of 16. They have trained under one of the most rigorous systems of discipline in the military world. A simple violation of rules results in 30 lashes, while something more severe, such as leaving one's post, results in hanging. The penalties are so harsh that even family members can be punished if a Hessian soldier misbehaves. Most of all, the Hessians' commitment to physical conditioning and drill is rigorous and ongoing, all in an attempt to produce not just the best soldier possible, but a mercenary force beyond compare. There is no reason to believe that the impoverished and barely trained American army stands a chance against such fighting men. Yet that is just what is now happening. As the hostilities turn to hand-to-hand combat, the men smell one another's stale breaths, body odors, tobacco, and last night's alcohol. They scream guttural warnings and commands in different languages, not understanding one another's words, but sensing the meaning. It is kill or be killed, with neither side having time to fire or reload a weapon. In the end, it will not be military prowess that turns the tide, but desperation. The Hessians begin to flee. The Princeton Road, which represents the primary path to escape, is quickly blocked by Washington's force. Another avenue of flight is the Assunpink Creek south of town, but the bridge from one side to the other is now in American hands. 2 Hessian gun crews attempt to stem the rebel advance, but they are thwarted as well. Americans capture their position and quickly turn their guns on the Germans. For the Hessians, so comfortable with precision and drill, the scene of confusion is like a vision of hell. Finally, the Hessian commander, Colonel Rawl, who ate a long Christmas dinner at the Green Tree Tavern and then drank well into the night, assembles himself and climbs into the saddle. Rawl now knows he was foolish to ignore warnings that the American attack was coming. Rawl, the son of an army officer, became an officer cadet himself at the age of 14 and has spent his entire life in the military. Throughout his 36-year career, Rawl has defeated opponents on battlefields in Europe, Asia, and America. He is far more experienced in battle than George Washington. Rawl believes that he can rout the rebels if he can personally rally his troops. Thus, the charismatic German commander hastily coordinates a charge into the American lines. From a nearby hill, George Washington watches the battle. His view is often blocked by the snow and smoke, so he cannot tell whether Rawl is succeeding. He is not. Colonel Rawl is soon shot twice in the abdomen. Mortally wounded, he falls from his mount and is evacuated to a nearby home, where he dies a few hours later. Found in his waistcoat is the warning passed to him earlier in the night from Loyalist spies. The Hessians continue to sprint out of the city, racing through the snow and frigid streams to the safety of the thick woods and orchards on Trenton's outskirts. A few hundred escape. Those who remain are soon surrounded by the Americans and taken prisoner. The stunned Germans look on as the rebels plunder their storehouses, steal their wagons, and cart off hundreds of pounds of vital supplies, ammunition, and cannon. Frightened Hessian grenadiers, attempting to endear themselves to their captors, offer up their brass-fronted helmets as souvenirs. Leaving his observation post, Washington now rides into Trenton to assess the victory. He plans to raise morale and encourage reenlistment by giving each of his soldiers a cash payout for his bravery, based upon the value of the plundered material. He wastes no time. 45 minutes after the battle begins, it is over. He then orders his soldiers to return, with their prisoners and the new cache of weaponry, to McConkie's Ferry and once again to cross the Delaware to avoid any counterattack by the remaining British and German forces in the area. The return journey is even more perilous than the initial crossing. The logistics of transporting the Hessian prisoners, captured artillery guns, and looted food stores require several trips back and forth through the icy waters for the weary boatmen. The flatboats are half flooded from rain and snow, subjecting soldiers and prisoners alike to the onset of frostbite as they stand up to their knees in freezing water. Ice floes dotting the river's surface have become more numerous and now stick to the boats, joining with the current to force some of the vessels downriver. The most effective way of freeing a boat from the ice is for the passengers to jump up and down repeatedly, which they do, taking great care not to fall overboard. As more and more of the riverbanks freeze over, it becomes impossible for some boats to reach the shore. Soldiers from both sides must step out and walk on the ice, many times breaking through and falling into the bitterly cold water. But most men make it, exhausted and battered, into Pennsylvania. Waiting for them is General Washington, who is analyzing the amazing victory. 21 Hessians are now dead, and 918 Germans are being held prisoner. Soon, these mercenaries will be turned over to the Pennsylvania militia to ensure they do not fall back into British hands. In addition, 6 brass Hessian cannon, 1,000 stands of arms, 15 prized Hessian battle flags, and 40 horses have been brought back to Pennsylvania. Footnote: a stand of arms consists of a musket, cartridge box, bayonet, and belt. However, most frequently, it was just a musket and bayonet. End footnote. Incredibly, only 4 American soldiers were wounded in the fight. None was killed. Footnote: among those wounded is an 18-year-old college dropout named James Monroe. A bullet shot through his chest severed an artery. Monroe would recover and go on to become the 5th President of the United States. In the famous painting Washington Crossing the Delaware by Emanuel Lutz, Monroe is depicted as standing behind the general holding the American flag. This is historically inaccurate. End footnote. Seeking to memorialize his victory, an exhausted George Washington turns to Major Wilkinson and says, "This is a glorious day for our country." But he knows it is far more than that. The victory at Trenton saved the entire rebellion from a ghastly defeat. Of that, there is no doubt.